Welcome to the Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks and a move. I'm Corey Johnson with episode number 157. Yes, there's lots of caffeine involved today. Hey, just ahead, the owner of famous footwear showing fantastic demand. And how the war in Ukraine has helped a U.S. LNG company big time. And another company based entirely on shopping center real estate, a business that dramatically changed with COVID. My conversation with Phillips Edison CEO Jeffrey Edison. But before that, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch lists and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And you can listen to The Drill Down on any of your favorite podcast platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, and more. A lot easier if you hit the subscribe button, follow us to catch every show.
And The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com. That's BRAINTRUST.com to learn more.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to The Drill Down. We've got business stories, which explains the move in some stocks. Other movements are unexplained, but at least we'll know what they should be doing. Help me figure all that out. Isaac Webster joins me right now from Los Angeles. Isaac,
yes, overcast Los Angeles.
Ooh, is it almost June gloom time?
Yeah, June gloom started in early May this year.
How about that? And now we've got LA weather up here in the San Francisco Bay area.
I mean, you know, if I believed in climate change, maybe it's part of that. Who knows?
Yeah, couldn't exist.
I just don't want to believe in that kind of thing. Now, Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Well, let's start with a St. Louis company called Caleres.
Caleres. Now, you know that all my family's from St. Louis, so I love it when we highlight St. Louis stocks. And Caleres trades under C-A-L, Cal. Cal shares have risen 9% in a year, really rallying over the past 5 days, actually.
Are we highlighting the stock or the business?
Tomato, tomato. Let's move on. Tell us what's going on with Caleres.
That is the exact difference.
Tell us what's going on with Caleres.
Because just talking about numbers, I read some story today about a company reporting earnings, a company we're going to talk about later in the show. And the first sentence in, I think, Investor's Business Daily was the move in the stock price. I'm like, the company just told you what it's doing. Why are you leading with the stock price? That's not what matters. What matters is what the company does. And Caleres is zigging when the world said it should zag. Caleres runs a business known as Famous Footwear. And one would think, if one looked at the market, at the stock market, at the breathless commentators on business TV, what passes as business TV, what's really stock market TV. Stock market TV says the consumer is not buying things. Stock market TV says inflation is ruining consumer demand. But the businesses, Famous Footwear, telling us that, in fact, demand is great, telling us that $735 million in revenues was up 15% from the year before, telling us that supply chain problems, forget about it. They say that in St. Louis? No, they don't. No. 35% more inventory than a year ago, and fundamentally telling us that what's happening on the consumer level is that the consumer is strong. Here's CEO Diane Sullivan.
I would say, you know, the consumer demand fundamentals, as far as we can see, remain very strong. I think we're extraordinarily fortunate that we have a portfolio of diverse brands like we have that reach so many different consumer segments and price points, along with, you know, Famous that really reaches so many consumers and has all the national brands that they really want. So quite honestly, we have not seen any significant change in the demand of the consumer in the last number of weeks. It's still as strong as April had been, and really don't believe that that's going to change that significantly for us as we, you know, move through the second quarter and through the rest of the year. Again, all to be seen, but we feel very confident in all of are the signals that we're seeing about our business. The second thing is that with respect to price elasticity and price increases, again, same thing. because of the much lower promotional environment, it's a lot quieter than it had been, as well as the fact that we really took our price increases up going into spring of this year. Again, feel like all of that looks like right now that is holding, and we really again believe that part of that has been we've always tried to deliver unbelievable value every day in the products that we deliver to the consumer. So that would be, I think, the second point.
So this is what Sullivan is calling their best ever first quarter performance in sales, in gross profit margins, and in earnings. Again, Isaac, this stock had actually sold off quite a bit going into this report. The market got it completely wrong. And now the stock is, trading the highest price it's traded all year.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
I want to look at Accelerate Energy from Woodlands, Texas, spelled as only an illiterate would, Accelerate with E-X-C-E-L-A-R-A-T-E. I'm sorry, Accelerate people, I'm insulting your grammar, but they spelled it as if it's a spreadsheet, not as if it's the word Accelerate.
Well, I'm sure they use spreadsheets within the company, so maybe that's where it stems from. But trades under EE, and EE shares are basically flat if you look at a 12-month chart, but they've jumped 10% over the past week.
Yeah, well, this company is growing fantastically. It's a recently public company that is in the LNG business. And, oil's been hot. LNG has certainly been super hot. And these guys really benefiting from the news that they broke on Friday, which was that Finland has, as we know, Finland and Sweden moving away from their independent status, worried about aggression from Russia. Not that Finland in particular hasn't always been worried about aggression from the Soviet Union, at least before it was just Russia now. But, they have fought wars with the Soviet Union and they're worried about their neighbor to the east. And as they move towards NATO, they're also moving away from Russian gas. The finance minister, I should say, Annika Saarikko, my Finnish is not great, Isaac. That might surprise you.
It's very surprising, yeah.
I think it passes Finnish.
Sure.
Maybe a little Scandinavian?
Sure.
There's zero Scandinavian in my DNA reports. But nonetheless, the finance minister from Finland saying they're going to move away from Russian gas and they're going to move towards Accelerate Energy's offerings of LNG, signing a 10-year charter for a floating storage and refrigeration vessel with this Texas-based company, Woodlands, Texas-based. Woodlands, Texas is in the suburbs of Houston. I know it well. What's interesting about this company, though, is already growing fantastically. So they reported earnings today, $592 million up, of revenue, I should say, $592 million, up 259% year over year. Profits, yes, profits, $13 million. Adjusted profits of $72 million, if you want to make those adjustments. And they announced a lot of progress in actual gas sales out of the Northeast Gateway Terminal in Boston Harbor. A full quarter of gas sales in Brazil. They moved ahead in projects in Bangladesh, in Argentina, as I mentioned, in Finland. And I thought it was really interesting to listen to Steve Kobos, the CEO of Accelerate Energy, saying that this might be the most important time for change in the oil and gas business since the 1970s OPEC embargo. Here's CEO of Accelerate Energy, Steve Kobos.
The energy crisis in Europe and the war in Ukraine have greatly increased the appeal of having flexible access to LNG as a means of promoting energy reliability and enhancing energy security. The potential for further disruptions of Russian pipeline gas to the region resulted in LNG cargoes that ordinarily would have been destined for the Asia-Pacific region being diverted to Europe. The increase in LNG volumes being imported to Europe have also driven spot LNG prices to record highs as countries who have historically been dependent on Russian gas are now competing for limited LNG supply. We expect this sequence of events to lead to a new wave of liquefaction projects taking FID, which will be additional to the more than 100 million tons per annum of new supply already announced through 2027.
So predictions of great growth in the LNG volumes from this young, fast-growing company, and one that I'm going to poke around in a little bit more. I'm sure they're up to everything's great. I've investigated both great companies and what I consider stock frauds in Woodlands, Texas. So we'll see what we got here. But this is they're certainly announcing lots of great growth in the near future for Accelerate EXEL.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
All right, well, we went from EE, the stock ticker. Let's go VVV, Valvoline.
Valvoline, as you said, VVV shares have risen just over 3% in a year, but year to date, they've lost 9%.
But maybe most importantly, what happened today to the stock, we're recording this on a Wednesday here, you saw just a fantastic move, the stock up 14%. After news in the Wall Street Journal that the state oil giant Saudi Aramco has been talking to Valvoline regarding a possible takeover deal. Now, there's no guarantee that two sides will reach a deal, and the talks are in early stages, according the Wall Street Journal says, to people familiar with the matter, as our friend Matt Miller would say. Well, why would you talk to people who aren't familiar with the matter? Of course, they're familiar with the matter, or at least they say they
according
are.
According to someone who has no context or connections to the company. Knows,
I talked to my four-year-old today, and they say the talks are in early stages.
Right.
Well, Valvoline is an interesting company. There has been a quiet activist campaign to get them to change their business practices. They have been extraordinarily resistant. This is just me talking. I have no position in Valvoline at the moment. And I just think that I'm super not impressed with what these guys have done and how they've responded to changes in their business. In particular, these guys have two businesses. They have a retail business and a products business. And the retail business has been doing really, really great. And their franchises in particular have been doing really great. And in response to some of these activist calls, they put out this tepid note saying that they were going to look, back in October, they put out a press release saying they were going to look at possibly splitting retail and products. Well, the retail business is just surging. And lots of stuff, once again, going against what we've been hearing about what the bubble TV people tell us, that that inflation is scaring consumers away and people aren't buying things. Well, their transaction growth, getting oil changes and so on, the main business there, has been really strong. They've seen price increases and they've been taking price, raising their prices, and they've found consumers willing to pay those higher prices to get these oil changes. And they've been able to, because of more transactions, because of rising prices, they think for the full year they're going to see about 13% increases over the course of the entire fiscal year. And, well, listen to what the CEO, Sam Mitchell, had to say on the conference call.
Transaction growth has continued to be quite strong. So we saw that in Q1 and again in Q2. And so that is one of the drivers behind our guidance for the full fiscal year, because we're just continuing to see that broad-based strength that we pointed out in the presentation. Pricing certainly is going to have an impact on the back half of the year, so we'll see a nice benefit in ticket performance in the back half of the year. And so the combination of the continued growth in transactions, somewhat above expectations, and then the increased pricing is going to put us in that 12-14% range for the full fiscal year. That does imply that, the growth that we saw in the first half will be lower in the second half because of the nature of the comps as we move past, like, the COVID-19 comparisons. With regard to price increase, we have a very disciplined process for how we take pricing. And, it involves, measuring price increases and potential impacts on our volume and transaction performance. But as costs have moved up pretty significantly, both on the product side and on the labor side, these price increases are very important for us to take. As we've made these adjustments, and as I noted earlier that we took these in April, we have also noted that our competitors have taken similar price increases. So when you take a look at pricing across the do-it-for-me market, prices to consumers are up across the board.
So yes, across the board, competitors raising prices, these guys are raising prices. should be good for everybody in the kind of auto repair space, if you will. I hate that cliche space. I just did it. But I got to say, so here you have a company in the midst of, now we know, potential acquisition target from Saudi Aramco. We know, and I say the earnings announcements was a few weeks ago, but I thought it was worth listening to what they had to say last time. And one of the things they did is they just didn't answer questions. They only took questions. You know, we on this show, every time we put out a show, we're quoting what the CEOs have to say in response to a single question usually. But typically these calls will go on for an hour and a half. They'll take a dozen questions, sometimes many, many more. These guys at Valvoline, in the midst of enormous criticism about the way that they run their business, with a stock price that had gone from 37 to 27 in the course of the last 5 months, took questions from just two friendly analysts and said, that's it, we're done. Bye-bye. Two analysts. They're buddies.
Mm-hmm.
Not taking controversial questions.
Because of their questions
and the ratings on the stock. That, you know, not facing the music, not facing the criticism, not explaining their business strategy when it is under fire from analysts who look at this and the activist investors who think that there is more money to be made here. Saudi Aramco, apparently, among them. So keeping an eye on Valvoline, keeping an eye on this sector as well, because as people get their cars on the road, they're going to need more repairs on those cars, and that could be good business for these guys, even if they're not maybe responding. I'm being kind. Should I be kind? Is it more fun?
Why start now?
All right. These clowns should be doing a better job than they're doing right now, and they should at least be explaining what they're doing to the people who buy their stock, the analysts who cover their stock, and yes, the activists who think they can do a better job. If these guys can't even handle the tough questions, it makes you wonder if they can handle making this business run better. I just think it's ridiculous. These guys are so chicken shit. Can I say chicken shit?
Well, you just did, so yes, you can.
To quote James Comey, chicken shit.
Dude, now this may sound really stupid, but in the whole electric car
industry. Stopped you before. No.
Industry, yeah, it's never stopped me before, exactly. But the whole, how is Valvoline going to play into the shift to electric? Do electric cars have a need for Valvoline's products? I mean, I feel like I should know this answer, but I really don't know.
Well, so yes, the cars get fixed and cars need repairs and cars need maintenance. There is an argument that, for example,
but the type of maintenance that an electric car would need, would that require Valvoline's expertise?
It may or may not need as much oil. It's not going to need as much, but the engines have fewer moving parts, yes. But they're 100% going to need maintenance, and that maintenance will include oil in some way. You know, who knows what an engine's going to look like in 10 years. But these cars are a lot heavier. They're going to go through things like tires a lot faster.
Right.
They're going to go through the other few moving parts they have a lot more frequently because of the weight of these cars. One of the only responses that these guys have had after this activist campaign begun was a change in their own description of their company. Their old description of the company I have here in my notes. I'm so glad you asked. They used to say, we're the leading worldwide marketer and supplier of premium branded lubricants and automotive services with sales in 140 countries established in 1866, blah, blah. Now they say, a global leader in vehicle care, powering the future of mobility through innovative services and products for vehicles with electric, hybrid, and internal combustion powertrains. So they clearly know that change is afoot, if not in the ownership of their stock, in the needs of their customers, and trying to respond to that with a new company description. We'll see if these guys can handle that with also changing the product offerings and the opportunity right there before them. Certainly the rising revenue guidance from this company suggests that there are trends afoot that's going to be positive for Valvoline. All right, coming up next, we're going to go in-depth into the grocery-driven shopping mall business and how much that's really changed during COVID, how we came to rely on businesses that became essential we might not have known were so essential. That's with the CEO of Phillips Edison, Jeffrey Edison, joins us right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast with a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
All right, welcome back to the Drill Down Podcast. We are joined right now by the CEO of Philips Edison. Jeff Edison, the CEO, joins us right now. I love, listeners, you know this, I love to talk about the grocery business, and here we are talking about grocery real estate, which is real close with this REIT that Jeff runs. Jeff, thank you for joining us. Well, how do you describe the business problem that Philips Edison solves?
Well, first of all, thank you for having us on me on the call. I appreciate it. You know, the problem that we solve is last mile delivery to the average American. And that is what our shopping centers do and have done pretty consistently over, you know, the 30 years we've been doing this this business.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about that, the sort of the history of the REIT business and how you guys have been involved in that for a long time, longer than this REIT has been around. But this is a this is stock ticker PICO. We don't give investment advice. This isn't about the stock. It's about the business. But Philips Edison is a REIT that has been around not for a super long time, but you are focused exclusively on the real estate of malls that are around outdoor of grocery, right? Or the areas around grocery?
All of our centers are open air. All of them are anchored by the number one or two grocer in the market that they're in. And they are across America. We have almost 300 properties. You know, yes, we have only been public since July last year. We were an SEC registered non-traded REIT before that for almost 10 years. And prior to that, a private company.
Yeah, and I must admit, I did not know that there were non-traded REITs registered with the SEC, private REITs, if you are, until I was reading through your documents. I've got a lot to learn. So you talk about where you are. Give us a little better sense. You say you're everywhere. Grocery is one of those businesses that tends to be, have, I won't say they're monopolies, because I know that's a legal technical term, but there are dominant players in different markets. And if you're in, we're in Northern California where I am right now, Safeway or Safeway. Yes, there's Albertsons, but it's Safeway and Safeway. Well, now it's the same. If you're in Chicago, it's Jewel. If you're in with some Kroger sprinkled around, if you're in upstate New York, it's Wegmans, and there isn't anything else, you know. That's true all over the country, yes?
Absolutely. And, you know, whether it's Publix or, you know, that, you know, everywhere you've got dominant. And our philosophy over a long time is that every market really needs to have at least two grocers, because the consumer doesn't just shop one grocer, doesn't only want one grocer, they want choices. And so in our mind, having number one or two grocers is really critical, because beyond that, it can drop off, as you were pointing out, can drop off pretty dramatically in terms of, you know, what the customer wants.
So as we look at that, so what does your typical center look like?
Yeah, so our typical center is 115,000 square feet. Right. It has a 50,000 square foot grocer. Again, the number one or two grocer in that market. And it's surrounded by small stores that are primarily necessity-based. You know, about 75% of our income comes from necessity-based retailers. And that's how we've, you know, that's our formula.
I couldn't tell in reading your financials how many of your centers I would see national chains. I'd see a Chipotle, I'd see a Starbucks, I'd see a Panda Express, or was it local dry cleaners and, you know, Jean's Music Center or something? You know, that was the name of my mother's music store, by the way, when I was a kid.
So it's about 25% local, and then about 30% regional, and the balance is national.
Interesting. How do those differ? Why is that a balance? I mean, that you get the balances you've got is what you get, but how do those differ in terms of risk, cost, duration of the lease, and so on?
Well, it's really driven by the type of retail it is, and there are certain segments like nails and, you know, a lot in the hair business and in, you know, the franchise businesses that have a local owner. It's really been driven primarily by how the retail market works. And, you know, the what we're always trying to do is to get the right merchandising mix for what is effectively a 3-mile radius around our centers. That's sort of how we look at it. And each market has a slightly different needs and different, you know, character. And, you know, whether it's a really high income, medium income, or centers, which is where we're primarily in, the needs of that consumer are different. And the retailers that want to be in those markets are different. You know, we do have a high degree of Chipotle's and Starbucks in our centers. But we also have a lot of local nail salons and laundries, and, you know, a lot of the fitness is franchised. Some of the food is franchised. But that's sort of how we do it. And it's a lot more of an art than a science, getting that right merchandising mix, where each of the different, we call them our neighbors, but everyone else calls them tenants, but right, where our neighbors can work really well together, and they benefit off of each other's traffic and help, you know, really, like when you leave your house and you got to do something that you need to do, a necessity-based thing, that you can do it in one spot in a really convenient way and get it done in a, you know, with a great selection of stuff, but be able to do it in a really efficient way. And that's, you know, everyone sort of probably has their shopping center close to their house that, you know, where they do a lot of that stuff. And getting that right mix is a big part of how we create value in these centers.
It seems like that's one of the pandemic effects that we've seen, is the importance of, or the frequency with which people go to the grocery store has let other kinds of companies move in near there. I think the one that struck me was small size Lululemon's, at Lululemon changing their footprint so they could be near a Whole Foods, because they figured out that their customers go to Whole Foods a lot more than they go to the mall where they used to find Lululemon.
Yeah. And it's the same for a lot of different customer groups, where they do want that. The retailers realize that they benefit each other, because Lululemon helps Whole Foods in the same way Whole Foods helps Lululemon, because it's a thing that, you know, that the shopper wants, and they're naturally attracted to that if you get the right mix.
So are you able to take lessons from one market and apply it to a new market where that market, you might have just acquired property there, but that, which we can talk about in a second, you're about to do a lot more of that, but that market might not have seen that, those lessons and that wisdom that you learned in one place that you can bring to a new place?
Yeah, we believe that, because a lot, you know, the grocery anchored shopping center business is a really fragmented business with a lot of people who own one or two centers. And when we're able to go in there and bring our national leasing team to that center, we can actually bring in neighbors that were not there before, because of our long-term relationships we've had with a lot of the retailers.
Do you acquire property in areas where you know that you've got other tenants? I'm not going to say neighbors. I know that you can say neighbors.
Yeah,
you know the difference between a neighbor and tenant?
Keep saying tenants. I'll say neighbors if it's okay.
I'm working from home today, and none of the houses around me pay me money. So they're my neighbors. They're not my tenants.
Right.
Anyone in this building should be paying rent, including my teenagers who won't.
Yeah.
you know, as you, are you able to sort of say, hey, I know that Starbucks wants to double their size in this particular market, and there is no Starbucks in this shopping center right now, but we're going to acquire this property because we know Starbucks is growing here, shrinking other places, and we've got that relationship. We might be able to bring in the tenant like that.
Absolutely. It's when we underwrite centers that we're buying, a lot of it comes with a strong leasing input from the guys who are on the ground saying, look, I can get, not only can I, you know, take the inline stores and do it, but maybe we can buy this outlot and we can get a Starbucks with full drive through and the convenience, and bring that to that community. And that community, knowing the demographics of the community, knowing the shopping habits of those shoppers, we can bring them something that is, you know, that they want to have in their community. And that's what we're hoping to do.
I'm going to name drop right now. You ready? So I was sitting with Magic Johnson once, and I was with the guy that ran his business. And at that time they had a partnership with Starbucks and his Urban Magic group. And I was talking to him about real estate, and then I was talking about some specific locations that they might be interested in, some downtown areas that I knew. And they were like, no, we need it has to be in a right-hand corner
so you can make the turn and you'll be in seat either side. There has to be outdoor seating. Like they had very specific knowledge of, you know, they had looked at every corner in Oakland, for example, like every street corner in Oakland, trying to figure out where they wanted to be.
And the national retailers have a format.
They all have that, right?
They have a format that works for them. They know the demographics they need, but they also know the physical plant they need. And a lot of that is that convenience. I mean, it's just, it's what goes through your mind as a customer. It's like, I'm not going to go get my Starbucks because I got to take that left turn in there and it's going to be a pain. You know, it's going to be all that traffic and then there's going to be a long, like, I'm just not. And they've been doing this for so long. They know what will work and what won't work. And they don't make that many mistakes because they've done the research to know where they can be successful.
And that's buy a lot on
the
of
national
that?
Side.
Well, and so they've got that. But I also know there have historically been firms that sell that information, that sell that kind of location data regarding kind of demographics, but really down to some really small scale. I would imagine that informs the decisions about what properties you're going to buy, because now that you're public, you do have a bigger sort of ability to buy cash. You've sold some shares and are able to spend some of that money.
Yeah, well, you know, Placer AI is just a great example where they're tracking your cell phone, and almost all the retailers are using that type of information today, and they know exactly who's driving by the store, you know, driving by the center. They know what the stores around them are doing. They know how that compares to other stores that they've had. And they can say, well, I'm going to do X millions of dollars of sales out of this location with a lot more accuracy than they have been able to do historically because of the additional information they have in their decision process. And it's really, in my mind, it's changed a lot of the real estate decisions.
Well, let me drill down a little more. What does that cell phone data show? Like what, you know, obviously it's aggregated and you don't own individual's stuff, but what does it show that it was, which was changed your business that you've been in for so long?
Well, I mean, a great example is when they can know that Kroger is doing $33 million. They, even though they don't know, Kroger doesn't tell them what their sales are. They can know that by looking at, you know, a week's traffic patterns of people going in and out of the store. And they know that of the centers of the stores that they have with a $30 million Kroger in that kind of a location, I can do this kind of thing. And they, you know, we used to, there was a long time ago where you actually did a similar thing, you know, looking at cars and looking at their license plates, and then you'd send the information in and they'd tell you who was there and that stuff. And now they do it almost instantly. And that is it's a game changer, I think.
Have you ever seen a situation where, I mean, obviously we're just going through this pandemic experience, but where you see that kind of real-time data on traffic and realize you might have a real estate problem coming up?
Yes. It's much for us. It's much more often that it is it's a retailer issue than it is a market issue. There are certain stores. I mean, just take some of the stores that are gone, you know, that are gone today that were here and, you know, taking our space 10 years ago. That was a retailer issue. It was not a locational issue. And being able to understand that difference is a big, you know, part of what we have to do when we're evaluating properties to buy.
But I guess I'm asking, is there an example where you've seen that cell phone data that and said, oh, wow, Blockbuster might have to move out soon. They're not seeing the traffic they used to.
Yeah. Well, we look at almost all of the retailers on that basis, and we can get a pretty good handle. Now, we oftentimes have their sales, so we know it, you know, beyond just, I mean, in a real, where, you know, where has the customer spent their money, which is always the best information. But this is has almost replaced that in importance or equal importance. As you look at it, because you can actually get a very good read on that. And, you know, it's the trends that the consumer is doing. And the thing we love about the retail business is that it's always the choice of the consumer. And it's oftentimes they're sitting on their couch and they're saying, okay, I got to go do this. Where am I going to do that? And then like what it's that taking their wallet out or their credit card out and tapping it and where are they going to do that? That's really the mentality that we have to have in terms of what type of merchants we put into our centers.
I'm also interested, you know, as you do that over time, when you were looking at, again, you're about to acquire a lot more properties, your acquisition pace is going to pick up. Apparently, you've also, you know, borrowed some money to do that with. What does a bad deal look like? What is a deal that someone else might bring to you and think it's good? And you got to say, yeah, no, here's why we won't do this.
Yeah. One thing, we've been a pretty strong growth company for 30 years. I mean, we've basically doubled the size of the company every 3 years for since we started. So the $1 billion that we're planning to buy over the next 3 years is actually slightly below what we've done historically. We haven't really accelerated the deal. But in terms of like bad deals, there are so many things that go into evaluating what we buy. It can be one thing. It can be access, as you talked about a little earlier. Like the access to a center may in our mind be an obstacle to ever being able to really bring the potential out in a shopping center that we want to do. And we've walked on deals because of that. You know, there are physical things. Today's environment, you know, the drive-through has become such a critical part. You know, are we able to do that? And that's not only a physical thing, but it's what the cities will allow and the counties will allow those shopping centers to actually do. Today to put in a Chipotle, if there's an obstacle to drive-through, you're probably not getting them as a tenant in your shopping center. Huh. So it is. They're very specific things that are really needed, and then there are a plethora of things, whether it's environmental issues or things that we've had to, you know, pass on centers because we didn't, you know, we thought that they were, you know, problems. So there's an awful lot that goes into the underwriting to make sure that you're getting what you actually think you're gonna get and what your plan is for the center.
And is the idea of grocery just that it's just so essential? I mean, certainly our relationship with grocery stores and, you know, as an essential thing, I don't know that anyone realized how essential it was until the pandemic when those were the only stores allowed to stay open.
For our small stores, which is where we make a lot of our money, it's the 1.7 times you go there. That's what's really the driver, because that drives your convenience location.
Sorry, 1.7, that's how often you go every week?
A week, yeah. That's how many times the average American goes to a grocery store a week. And if you think about retail and you think about what retailer do you go to 1.7 times a week, there's almost none. And that's why the grocer is so valuable to our shopping centers and why they're such an integral part of our strategy.
What do you make of the struggles that urban areas have seen? I know in the last week I've been in Los Angeles, well, Hollywood more than anywhere, Seattle and San Francisco. And Seattle and San Francisco in particular, the downtown areas, are the businesses are still closed, workers are not there. And so the street scene is just different. Things are boarded up. The percentage of homeless people to not homeless people, you know, rents are higher than ever. And so the fringe population that is homeless is struggling so much more because it's impossible to rent in those places at reasonable prices. And there's no one else on the street. What does that mean for your business, and where do you see that trend going?
Yeah, so fortunately for us, we have almost no urban footprint. All of our is suburban. You know, all of our centers are suburban, and you know, we're obviously rooting for the cities to come back and, you know, get their vibrance back that they had, and I think it's going to be a long road. I don't think it's going to be a quick COVID's over and everyone's back in the city. You know, the suburbanization is something that, you know, was happening before the pandemic. And when you think about what work from home means, it means you're going to be closer to our centers more of the day. And we're going to get a bigger chunk of what you consume. And we've had, it's been an advantage to us. Obviously, it's not what, you know, you don't want any city to have the kind of problems, but these are pretty serious issues that are, nobody has a real great solution to them, because it is crime, it is, you know, homelessness, it's the security that people need where they live, and the cities had that, and they've lost some of that, and they've got you know, they've got to address it and figure out how to make it work, because safety is one of the top five things every consumer mentions when they look at the things they want in a shopping environment.
Really interesting. Let me ask you we're almost out of time here, but I want to ask, again, I don't care about the stock really, I just care about the business, but you are a REIT, you pay out most of your profits and dividends, and you pay it monthly. Why do you pay monthly?
Well, we generate about $80 million of free cash flow, and we pay a dividend of about that's after our dividend. Our dividend is about 60% of our cash flow, that's how we've sort of played that, and that gives us growth capital and stuff. We give a monthly dividend because our foundation of our investor base is retail investors, and our retail investors love to get a check in the mail every month. They just love it. And you know, the institutional guys say, well, I get the cash or I get the value increase. But for the retail investor, who's a very important investor to us, they love it, and we've always done it. And it's a little more expensive to do, but it's, you know, it's very valuable to some of our investors.
Well, your time is valuable. I won't take any more of it. Jeff Edison is the CEO of Phillips Edison, and we appreciate your time. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Right, appreciate it. Next, it was great talking to you. Have a great day.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the Drill Down Bite, the one number that tells us a whole lot about Phillips Edison.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. With Era, give yourself an information advantage. Connect directly to earnings calls and other investor events with live transcription and event intelligence. That's Era, AIERA.com.
If you stood outside the windows of my very old house and yelled through my very old windows, you could yell at my smart speaker, "Hey Alexa, play the Drill Down podcast." You'd want to run away before my dog would attack you, because she's unfriendly at times. But you can ask your smart speaker or someone else's smart speaker to play the Drill Down podcast. That means to each serving of business news and business stories behind stocks and a move, by just asking your smart speaker to play the Drill Down podcast. All right, we're back with a bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot about the Drill Down's big story today about Phillips Edison. And Isaac, so we talked about how all of these stores, all these grocery stores, are anchoring these essential shopping malls. But, you know, every once in a while, a grocery store will move or go out of business or change. So you wonder how much anchor occupancy these guys have. If the anchor tenant is a grocery store, but the grocery store isn't there, and that surely happens at times, how often does it happen for these guys? So here's your number. 97.6% of their shopping malls, 0.6 would be, I guess, referring to how many months during the year, had their anchor tenant in place. So these guys not only have their anchor tenants for most of their malls, they keep those anchor tenants almost all the time, driving, making sure this business really is being led by those anchor tenants, the grocery tenants that they say are leading this business. So, well, fascinating business, grocery, you know, as I keep saying, one of my favorite businesses, because it's so simple to figure out in some ways, but interesting that it's driving so much real estate value as well.
Yeah, you know, that's got to be tough to keep those anchor tenants in place.
Well, the sophistication that they have about knowing what location to be in and how to monetize the best possible place to be is really interesting, with all the data that we talked about there, cell phone data and so on. That, yeah, they know where they want to be, and I guess once they find that spot, they want to keep it. Hold your corner. If it works in the wire, it works for Safeway. All right, thanks for listening to Drill Down. We do appreciate it. I'm Corey Johnson, Isaac Webster, executive producer. Ben Wilson is our editor extraordinaire. And the Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.